From the International Association of Marriage and Family Counselors, I'm Robert Caceres, and this is The Reframe. Today's guest is Dr. Lee Tufel-Prida. Dr. Tufel-Prida is an assistant program director and core faculty member for Counseling at Northwestern, an online graduate program affiliated with the Family Institute. A licensed clinician in both California and Florida, Dr. Tufel-Prida has nearly 20 years of counseling experience, working with children and families in community agencies, juvenile justice facilities, and private practice. She also conducts research in the area of technology-assisted counseling, and she reflected on its benefits for addressing rural and underserved populations.
A lot of attitudes and beliefs are shifting when it comes to mental health and wellness and caring for themselves, but it doesn't change that their access or their ability to access those services, that hasn't changed. And so attitudes and beliefs can change and shift over time, but the ability to access those services might not. And so ultimately, I think the ability to do that, you know, is important. And then also people are busy. Ask yourself, you're busy, but you still want to take care of yourself. The average person today experiences a high rate of feeling pulled in multiple directions, but they still know they want to take care of themselves. They want to feel as though they're nurturing their wellness and overall well-being. And when given the opportunity to find something that is more accessible, more convenient, I think a lot of people will jump at that opportunity.
Welcome to The Reframe. Over the next hour, you'll hear Dr. Tufel-Prida share her passion for advocacy work, discuss the evolution of technology's use in counseling, and offer tips for sustaining an active research agenda.
I think the best way for me to stay focused on still doing scholarship, because I'm administratively heavy and that I'm so bought into my colleagues and the team of people that I work with, is to then relationship build with them and be tied into relationships. So if I'm doing scholarship with other people, then I know I'm held to deadlines and responsibilities of doing scholarship with them. If it's just singular research or what have you, I'm more inclined to go, never mind.
We began our conversation by discussing how Lee transitioned to her current academic role, and she shared some of the benefits of working remotely.
And so I knew of Northwestern's affiliation with the Family Institute and that they were starting a new counseling program online, or they had just started a relatively new program called Counseling at Northwestern. And so when I saw that, I thought I should keep my eyes on that. And then when I saw them call out for directors of training, I thought, my goodness, that's my area of expertise, and I've done that before. And so if I'm going to, you know, look to leave Walden, I thought I should talk to these people. And then my husband and I were looking to move back to California. He's Mexican, but had lived in the United States for about 20 years, and we have a home out here in California. And I had gotten licensed in California. And because I had started doing some distance counseling in Florida, I was able to make that transition. And obviously, being in an online program, I could live anywhere. I live in Pasadena, California. I live right by the Rose Bowl. I joke with people that for a percentage of the year, it actually does smell like roses.
Oh, truly, yeah.
It truly does, because, well, one, it's, you know, Southern California, it's a Mediterranean climate, but it's really beautiful. So I live in Pasadena, California, but I work for Northwestern University. So, I guess I get the benefit of both worlds.
Yeah, that idea of living anywhere, when I talk with my students, is like such an awe-inspiring possibility. But then there's the daunting task of getting licensed or provisionally licensed in another state. And I'm just curious what that experience was like for you, you know, having been licensed in Florida and then having to go through the licensure process in California.
Well, there's a bit of my personality, and I think other counselors maybe relate to this, that I view counselors as chameleons, that we get the opportunity to change our skin and do a lot of different things and work with different populations. And so I've really always taken the opportunity to be that chameleon and change my skin and work with different people, different populations. And so I jump at that opportunity. The other thing, when it comes to licensure, I say this to my students, that it's a challenge for everybody. It's a challenge for even us as professors. that it's not an easy feat. It's often a lot of hoop jumping. When it came to getting licensure in California, I really joke about it because I've written book chapters on counseling children. They made me take the counseling children course. So I really laugh about it because I'm considered a quote unquote expert in the field when it comes to counseling children, but I didn't have a specific course that said counseling children. The way my transcripts looked, it wasn't as simple as that. And it also didn't say counseling children in California. And so, again, I use that as an example and a narrative for my for the students that I work with, as, you know, it really is that hoop jumping experience, and really not to be daunted by it, really to see it as a challenge. And that's what I do. I look at it as a challenge when I'm doing licensure or working through licensure. And so I think my licensure number in California is like something like 218 or 200 and something. So it's really early in the licensure process, the first year that they did licensure in California. And so I enjoyed being in part of that process when they were still trying to figure it out. And again, working with students about a lot of that anxiety and that trepidation about, should I actually go through this? And this is really frustrating. And I always say, of course, you know, go for it. And then now with distance counseling, online education, you know, I really think the only thing stopping us is that frustration.
So it seems like just having a positive mindset from the beginning of saying, like, you know, brace yourself. This probably isn't going to go smoothly or perfectly. But
oh, yeah, definitely not.
It's going to work out in the end. And that mindset of it's certainly worth it helps you to kind of just persevere. And it sounds like it has been worth it.
Wholeheartedly. And so I just kind of keep chugging at it. And sometimes it, you know, my California licensure took, you know, I waited. You know, I think a lot of counselors did. It was the last state to ratify licensure. And I was waiting, you know, when is it going to get done? And so, you know, sometimes patience and perseverance pays off. And now I've been really fortunate to be able to use that license here in California and then still work with clients virtually. And unbeknownst to a lot of people, California and Florida and some other states, California and Florida, really high on that list. Clients are really looking to use services virtually. Those are high census states, but those are also states that people are really willing to use technology to access service. I didn't know that when I got licensed in these states, but it maybe speaks to how progressive the people are and the states are when it comes to accessing service.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned earlier being, or that you currently live in Pasadena, and I grew up in California. And so when people hear that, they assume it's, you know, the nice ritzy lifestyle of Pasadena or, you know, the coast. And rather I grew up in, you know, rural central California. And so I think about, you know, growing up in a really small town and there not being access to those services where people who, you know, my parents still live in that town, you know, they might have to drive 30, 45 minutes an hour, you know, to get to a clinician who might specialize in
right.
you know, a special issue that they might want to, you know, really dive deeply into. And so, yeah, 100%. It sounds like the telecounseling is a tremendous resource.
Exactly. And I think often, you know, we can see across the country, people, a lot of attitudes and beliefs are shifting when it comes to mental health and wellness and caring for themselves, but it doesn't change that their access or their ability to access those services that hasn't changed. And so attitudes and beliefs can change and shift over time, but the ability to access those services might not. And so ultimately, I think the ability to do that, you know, is important. And then also people are busy. Ask yourself, you're busy, but you still want to take care of yourself. The average person today experiences a high rate of feeling pulled in multiple directions, but they still know they want to take care of themselves. They want to feel as though they're nurturing their wellness and overall well-being. And when given the opportunity to find something that is more accessible, more convenient, I think a lot of people will jump at that opportunity. And often, you know, technology-assisted counseling really is the avenue that can then that can maintain that for people.
So it sounds like there's not only a need for telecounseling, but also a tremendous opportunity for aspiring clinicians. What advice or what recommendations would you share with aspiring professionals who are just coming in to the field, who want to, you know, enter into that realm of professional counseling?
I would say the reality is they're probably already doing it. I think that most clinicians aren't aware that there is an aspect of their practice, either even in practice and internship, or also current clinicians in community mental health or private practice, that if they were to really look at what they're doing, there's aspects of their practice that are already technology assisted. So if we look at the history of technology and technology assisted counseling, you know, years back, 30 years, we weren't using email. We weren't using medical records that were digital. We weren't calling clients at the rate that we're calling them now. We weren't sending text messages to clients, what have you. So there are elements of almost every level of working with clients that have some element of technology. And I make the parallel here to education. You really can't go to college now or get a master's degree and not have some level of technology-assisted education. And so there's really a misnomer that we're not using technology to assist our clients. It's just how much do you really want to incorporate that into your practice? And so I think as time goes by, I think we're going to slowly decrease our bias to incorporating technology and increase our expertise in incorporating it. So again, if we look 10 years ago, I think there was a lot of bias in incorporating technology because the technology wasn't as smooth. It was clunky. I don't think we had the policies and procedures and the legality behind it to really ensure that it was smooth and that it was client-centered to really ensure that it was done right and done well. But over time, I think those things have really improved. Right. So that we now know that we're working with clients just like you and I are having this interview today. The technology is drastically improved. I think you can read physical cues, emotional cues very accurately online. And so that bias is decreasing. So we now know that you can access and work with a client and really ensure that their care is done well and done ethically and legally in a way very parallel, if not better in many instances than you would in a face-to-face way. So I think it becomes, to answer your question, for a person getting into the field or currently in the field, it's a matter of how much and then also how much do they really want to build their expertise, knowing that they're probably already doing some elements of it.
So yeah, rather than having to acquire all of that knowledge from zero, it's really kind of an incremental building on what they're already doing that maybe they consider, technology assisted. That reminds me of an article that you recently published in the Family Journal called Technology Assisted Counseling for Couples and Families. And I just want to read a brief excerpt from that and ask you to reflect on it if you'd be okay with that. One of the quotes that I really appreciated said, "Counselors are using distance counseling in increasing numbers. Marriage and family counselors recognize the special opportunities to include clients in the therapy process and provide access to underserved groups. The future is now. Training programs, professional associations, researchers, and leaders in technology-assisted counseling can lead the way." So that last sentence, those who are in leadership positions, how would you like them to lead the way to ensure that this great opportunity and this technology allows the services that people need to become more accessible?
I would really like to see leaders in the field and educators work to decrease the bias that this is less than, in that working in this modality can be very empowering and also when you're working with clients, not only empowering for clients that are unable to access services, but fills a gap that I think counselors and have been reluctant to discuss because of that bias for some time. So I would look to leadership and educators to break down those barriers. I see people that access services through technology really as a population of people that fit using this modality. So just like any population of people, I think it behooves us as leaders and educators to build on those opportunities to decrease barriers and boundaries and really push the limits of how we can work with the populations of people that this is their preferred way of accessing services. So that's what I would like to see, is that as a leader saying, this is how we can ultimately assist this population of people, that this is how they get well, is through using this this platform or this service, or because we know that it's evidence-based for several populations.
And in that same article, you basically provide the chronology that you alluded to earlier of how technology has evolved and, you know, slowly and incrementally integrated into counseling. And at the end of the article, you kind of, you know, as many articles do, call for additional research. And I was wondering if you would share with the audience where those areas of additional research in the immediate future would be that would really kind of add to that body of literature.
Definitely. I think the breadth and depth of research in technology-assisted counseling is still really lacking, in that there's been a handful of articles that have looked at this modality, but really building the breadth and depth of that needs to improve. And with anything with technology, it's ever changing and improving. So 5 years ago looks very different than today. So I think it's important to quantify and qualify what kind of technology you're using. Again, to make the parallel to education, not all online counselor education programs look the same. So it would be the same as saying and doing technology-assisted counseling with couples, families, or individuals. What kind of tech are you using? I mean, I just don't think it's fair to say that text counseling is the same as just like this interview where I can see your face and I can read your verbal expressions and your body language. It's just not the same. So I think it's important if we're going to be doing research, you know, to keep up with the technology. Now, that's a big get. You know, I think if you're going to be doing research in this area, I think, you know, you have to be a bit of a techie and be willing to kind of, you know, keep up with things and also be willing to go more specific to the population. So when I said earlier, I'd like to see the decrease in bias and, you know, ultimately see an improvement in the overall population of people that see benefit from this modality. But within that, there's even specific populations of people that benefits from this. And so there's been limited research in using this with couples and families. And to me, the possibility there is far reaching. If you think about couples alone, I think it's really wonderful just to entertain the idea. Family starts to get a little challenging, although well needed. I can't tell you how many families tell me, I would love to be able to talk to my mom or my dad that I'm estranged from, but they live in Connecticut. I can't get them into a counseling session, but I want to talk to them. The challenge there starts to become licensure, and the ability to do this in a modality where you're supposed to be licensed in the state that you practice. That's a challenge. But I think as we start to see improved licensure portability and the ability to access these types of services and do this type of counseling over time, that's also another area that I would really like to see leadership improve upon. If we're able to get to a place where we have licensure portability, I think it really would improve the access ultimately.
So you're very passionate about the idea of technology and integrating that effectively in an evidence-based way. I wonder, how are you able to kind of balance the demands of your job at Northwestern as an assistant program director and still conduct research and do technology-assisted counseling and your other responsibilities? How do you balance all of those things?
I always joke that I'm partially cyborg and I'm connected to the mainframe. And I have these two, snoring therapy dogs, that are with me kind of all the time. I mean, I eat, breathe, and sleep counseling, counselor education, and Abby. And I have a very small caseload of clients that I see virtually. But I believe in what I do. I really do. And so when you said, that this is really, that the future is now, that this is what's going on, I really believe that. As a assistant program director in an online program, I really live and advocate for digital education. I believe in it. I think that I'm an advocate for that. Same thing with, technology assisted counseling. I believe in it. So I think when you're passionate about something, it doesn't feel like you're doing it all the time. I think you can sit and do it and absorb the other people in your life to kind of believing it as well. And get up and walk around a little bit and smell the roses.
Yeah, I need to be better about that.
Yeah.
So in terms of just practically speaking, if counseling is something that's kind of something you eat, sleep, and breathe, are there times where you have to remind yourself, I need to do scholarship, or there's something that, I put on the back burner? How do you redirect your attention to some of those other things that might vie for your time that may not be as pressing, but are still important responsibilities?
Well, when the tenure door is knocking and they're like, okay, it's time to start going up for the next thing. As an administrator, it's hard. It's definitely more difficult to find the time to do scholarship because I'm administratively heavy in my time. I think the best way for me to stay focused on still doing scholarship is because I'm administratively heavy and that I'm so bought into my colleagues and the team of people that I work with is to then relationship build with them and be tied into relationships. So if I'm doing scholarship with other people, then I know I'm held to deadlines and responsibilities of doing scholarship with them. If it's just singular research or what have you, I'm more inclined to go, never mind. I'll wait on that. That can wait because these other competing agendas of, seeing a client or doing administration or what have you, those tend to win. I'll put my need lower. But if I'm in relationship with other scholars, other colleagues, that keeps it higher on the list.
Yeah, I noticed that two of the recent articles you published were co-authored with colleagues from Northwestern.
Yeah, and those were actually graduate students.
Oh, wow.
And then one professor. So again, if I have buy-in where I'm doing it with colleagues or graduate students, the second and third author were graduate students. And the fourth author was a fellow professor at Northwestern. Again, I need buy-in to know that I'm responsible with other people and I get things done.
Yeah, so going back to those two articles in the Family Journal, that's two articles in one journal in 6 months. What mm-hmm. about the Family Journal made it a good landing spot for your work?
So Dr. Stephen Southern is the chair of the on-ground program at Northwestern University. And so have a collegial relationship with Dr. Southern and had the opportunity to interface with him quite extensively around some of the interests that myself and Dr. Don Lyrick, who I'm very close with and whose work I'm very honored to work rather extensively with her. She's very passionate about research and she really inspires me to do more research. If you were to look at my vita, she's one of those people that I'm in relationship with and it was like, let's do this, let's write this. And if I didn't have, and I really encourage all professors and administrators to have those type of people that are doing things and that are getting research and scholarship done. And so in conjunction with her, and then knowing Dr. Southern was the editor of the journal, he was like, submit it, see if you know, we'll take it. And we were fortunate enough that upon peer review those were accepted.
Something that I hear from students a lot is, you know, I don't necessarily want to get a PhD, but I still want to do research. And so it sounds like kind of that collegial collaborative nature of working relationships can help someone to be productive. Would you recommend for, say, master's level licensed clinicians who want to do research to kind of network and develop those relationships with people who might have a bit more experience in conducting evidence-based research?
Oh, wholeheartedly. As I'm alluded to, I don't get really much of any research or scholarship done unless I know somebody that's doing things. And, you know, at Northwestern or counseling at Northwestern, we really encourage our graduate students and even post-graduation, we say those types of things. Not many people take us up on it, but same thing with clinicians in the community. You know, if people are interested in this or other things, you know, please, I think it's very important. I think sometimes as counselor educators, we can be a bit in our ivory tower that we're the makers and readers of knowledge. I think it's more meaningful at times if people that are actually the clinicians that are out there seeing clients, if they're the makers of knowledge, that's very meaningful. I would really encourage people to do that.
That really resonates with me. I recently moved to North Carolina. And so I've been in this position for 1 year, and it was so important to me to get immediately licensed because I wanted to do clinical work with couples and with families. And as I was kind of scratching my head of, you know, how do I generate ideas to be productive as a researcher? Every one of my ideas has come from my clinical work.
Right.
Yeah. So it's a very rewarding and, you know, generative experience. And you said another thing that really resonates with my experience as well, which is, you know, as counselor educators, you know, we say, you know, perhaps very genuinely, wholeheartedly to our students, you know, this relationship doesn't end when you graduate.
Yeah.
You know, we would love to be future collaborators, and yet very few students ever take us up on that.
Yeah, I think they get caught in the weeds. You know, they're busy, you know, seeing clients and what have you. And I think that as a field, we could probably do much better at that. Again, we're not just the makers of knowledge and the readers of knowledge. You know, how do we ultimately maintain those connections, those scholarly connections?
And I guess I think about the recent graduates out there who might want to take a former professor up on that, but are a bit hesitant. What would you say to them?
Yeah, maybe, again, it would be nice to brainstorm how we do that, how we maintain those connections. And I think we can keep the door open, the invitation open, and maybe the solution is more a preventative solution, that we don't burn them out while they're in graduate school, so they want to run away and feel healthy and whole while they're post-graduation, and that it feels more connected and whole while they're there, you know.
So you've spoken about the evolution of technology. You've spoken about kind of where technology-assisted counseling is presently. Where do you envision technology integrating with counseling in, say, 10 years from now? Or where would you hope it would be?
Well, again, I think I would like to have it be in a place where there's a really large decrease in that bias, that people are just like, oh, well, you had a session and it was online, that there's not the assumption that it's less than, that it is on par and parallel to an on-ground experience. And that also I would like to see the technology get there. I think we're close. I think that there's been so much improvement and I would like to see the research to support that the evidence-based research to support that technology-assisted counseling is parallel and on par with in a face-to-face or on-ground experience. And that means really looking at the modalities of technology. So does that mean that, you know, text or email or, you know, where I'm able to video conference with you, what does that look like in comparison to an on-ground or physical counseling experience. And so in 10 years, I would anticipate that we'll have research to really support looking at what are the evidence-based practices for different populations so that over time we're able to decrease that bias. So that when you're working with a client, you can say confidently that delivery method you're using, you feel confident in saying that it's parallel and that you're providing a service to your clients that is evidence-based, ethical, and legal all in the same. And I think we will get there. I really, truly do. Knowing that what the last 10 years has looked like, the next 10 years, I would think, would only be exponential.
Well, again, going back to that passion that you have for technology-assisted counseling, and that seems like a theme that's run through everything you've described as incredibly passionate. And when you reflect on the diverse types of work that you do with various populations, what are some of the particularly enjoyable aspects or fond memories you have about the work that you've done?
Well, I think that the most fond memories I have are really breaking down barriers and working with people and children and families in ways that people wouldn't expect. And so some of that has been face-to-face, you know, and environments that people are like, oh, I wouldn't do that. And I'm like, oh, I'd love to do that. And I also get a bit of a giggle out of, you know, when people ask me what I do and they're like, really? I wouldn't do that. Or, you know, that's really what I enjoy. So those are my fond memories is, you know, early experiences doing play therapy in some of the worst parts of Tampa, Florida, you know, community mental health, doing play therapy, but doing play therapy in a building that they called the Palace. And the reason why they called it the Palace was because it was almost an oxymoron. It didn't look like a palace. It had bars on the windows. And, you know, there were frequently, you know, shootings in the neighborhood. And it was the opposite of a palace. But it was a place where people would say, I wouldn't work there. Those were my fond memories for getting my doctorate and then working online and having people tell me that's going to ruin your career. And now being, you know, post that, where people are saying, I hope that you can work for me because we need somebody who knows how to do that. So again, doing things that people wouldn't automatically agree to, I get a giggle out of that. I really do.
Well, you talked about kind of having, again, those diverse experiences. So you've worked in community agency settings, you've worked in private practice, and you've also worked in the juvenile justice system. Mm-hmm. Could you tell me about some of that work?
Sure. Again, I remember pulling up to, like, you know, all the bars and like having to be buzzed into like Department of Juvenile Justice facilities, thinking, and I had interviewed totally offsite, so I hadn't really seen it, but I knew like I wanted to work with juveniles because I had worked with kids for years. And I thought this is going to be great. But I pulled up and I saw them all marching and them all like basically like, being treated as inmates. And I hadn't anticipated that. And I thought, I sat in my car and I thought, what did I get myself into? Like, and I went through the whole phase of thinking, feeling almost incarcerated myself, because, you know, you're getting buzzed in, you're getting buzzed out, but then really feeling like it was probably one of the most rewarding experiences I had. I saw them really change, go through a lot of growth, worked, did a lot of family counseling, saw a lot of trauma, a lot of grief. And so I did that for, you know, a handful of years and really thought, this is a really powerful counseling experience to have if you're willing to also take care of yourself, work through yourself. I saw a lot of lack of supervision. A lot of counselors experienced burnout because they did get enmeshed. So it was a very valuable growing experience. And I, again, saw a lot of need for a lot of good family work.
Well, if you don't mind sharing, what were some of those things that you were very intentional and kind of mindful of that you did to ensure that you had adequate self-care and that you sought out the necessary supervision?
I think the the most obvious thing for me was, again, when I first pulled up and thought, wow, this was not what I expected. And I, that first kind of visceral reaction, and I had a choice to make. I could either walk in and do it, or I could walk away. And I think I've had a lot of those kinds of experiences. I made a conscious choice. I'm going to walk in, I'm going to do this, but I'm also going to call and make sure that I have a supervisor and that I also see my own counselor. And so it was a conscious choice, I think, you know, making those choices. And so the whole time I was engaged in that job, I had an outside supervisor, a supervisory group of colleagues, and I saw a counselor. And I think I learned and grew the whole time, but it was an active process of making sure that I, when I left there and I started to feel like, what if I get pulled over? What if I get arrested? Just random kind of worries, because you're always in an incarcerated situation. I made sure that I went and talked to my outside supervisor, my outside supervisory group. All the things we learn in school, but sometimes we as counselors, or we as students, we as counselor educators think, I'll do it later. Or, I'll wait and do that another time. It was just a very conscious choice.
Yeah, it does sound very intentional. You mentioned a while back that as counselor educators that we have to work very strategically to not burn our students out. And yet that idea of like, oh, you know, I'll do something later. That's something I hear from my students. Like, I'm going to relax and take care of myself when I'm done with school.
When I'm done.
Yeah. But then, you know, as you've illustrated, there's so many more responsibilities and opportunities for growth. Once you've graduated, really the learning just begins.
Begins. Yeah.
So is there additional advice or insight that you would share for those students who have recently graduated to kind of facilitate that ongoing professional development?
One thing I'm kind of big on is having a peer supervisory group, like a group of colleagues, because sometimes people will resist the temptation of getting an outside supervisor because it's sometimes cost prohibitive. So they'll take the supervision that they're given at a site. And so sometimes it's not wonderful, just like it's not wonderful supervision at their practicum or their internship. So that trend just kind of continues, and that they get mediocre to poor supervision. And so I can recommend until I'm blue in the face to get outside supervision or pay for that so that they get something that's very meaningful or valuable. But one thing I try to promote is doing peer supervision or a peer supervisory group with a bunch of colleagues. So they're bound by the same confidentiality, the same kind of group collegiality, that's something meaningful for them, right? They'll often agree to that because there's no financial implication. You know, there's a place for community, there's a place for support, right? I've seen some benefit in that because they'll often agree to that. I can almost quasi sell it, and that find your people. Find the people that you have community with, that you can still continue to grow with.
Yeah, that kind of echoes what we might say as counselor educators, you know, find your theory or find what, right, you know, you find resonates with you. And mm-hmm. analogously, you know, as you graduate, find those people who inspire and encourage you and
exactly.
who, you know, help you to stay grounded, but also motivated and to challenge mm-hmm. yourself.
Yeah.
So you've described, again, your diverse experiences and various ways that you've found ways to express your passions and find really a lot of value and meaning in your work as a counselor. But you're also actively involved in professional associations. And I'm curious, what are some of the leadership positions you've held or ways that you've tried to contribute to the profession through associations?
So I'm currently the co-membership chair for IAMFC. And so I think that that's one way. Several years ago, I was in charge of the interprofessional committee at ACA, and then they disbanded that particular committee. So those have been my primary leadership positions within the larger association. As far as giving back, I tend to be more university specific. So like committees within my university, more leadership within the university or it's been more administrative within my given university. I know a lot of counselor educators are very focused on leadership as far as associations and what have you. I've always participated, but I've not been as macro as many of my colleagues. I definitely like being involved and participating and what have you. I guess I've gotten nudged to do more, like, you know, go bigger or, you know, more involved. And I guess I've resisted that. You know, I've gotten the opportunity to maybe be even more involved and asked, why haven't you gone to try to be, you know, be bigger and badder in some of these organizations? I'm not uber charismatic or I'm not uber showy, and I don't like to travel too much. I guess maybe that's maybe why technology assisted or online is appealing. I end up staying home. So I'm not a big conference person. So I don't get too involved.
I'm sure there are plenty of professionals out there who might feel the same way. You know, I'm not showy. I'm not, you know, super extroverted. And yet counseling is a great profession for them. That's a great fit. Are there other aspects of the counseling profession that have just kind of really suited your temperament or personality?
I think the things that do suit my temperament or personality are relationship. I like relationship. I like people. I do like being equitable and being consistent and ensuring that people receive services. And access to care. And so that's always been an advocacy and doing it better. And so that's really been the appeal to me of the technology assisted and working with marginalized populations and children. But conferences and doing a ton of publication, I've just not had the pull to do that. And then similarly, you know, as a counselor educator, I love great policy procedure, doing it equitably, consistently, but in my own like kind of contained, relatively smaller world, which sounds counterintuitive that technology assisted would work for me, but it's all within the comfort of my home.
I love the way you describe that because it really reflects how I envision counseling, how I describe it to other people, mm-hmm. is that such a blending of art and science. And I guess depending mm-hmm. on your personality and your interests and your temperament, it might be a little bit more art or a little bit more science. And it just sounds like, you know, counseling, there's a place for you because they're your people. Or, yes. you know, there are a variety, you know, a whole spectrum of theories. And so, you know, for anyone out there maybe considering counseling as a profession, but saying like, oh, I don't necessarily immediately think of people like me being counselors. It sounds like in your experience and in my experience, there's a place for those people.
100%. I think there's always a place for every counselor. And so when I started a counseling at Northwestern, we have a placement team and we're always trying to place people. And so I got asked that question, what if people can find placements for practicum and internship? And I said, that's just a faulty assumption. I said, there's a place for everybody. And there's always going to be a place for people to train. It's just a matter of finding that place. And especially with the advent of working technologically, that's only going to get bigger and better and wider. And I really do envision that future is only going to look brighter for people to ultimately work with all the populations that need help. It's really just up to us as counselors to ultimately find these opportunities to service the people that need it and for us to find the places for us to feel comfortable and at home doing that. But I do think that that's going to, you're very, very right. There's a place for all of us counselors.
Well, as we wrap up, the show is called The Reframe. And so I was curious if there's some time in your life where you've looked at a situation and you just thought about it in a different way, and that way of reframing what may have been a difficult or a challenging situation really served you well.
I'm never shy about sharing it. I have dyslexia, so I have a learning disability. So I regularly reframe to myself that my greatest challenge is also my greatest strength. So often I say that to students is that if you have a great challenge, it often is your greatest strength. And so I think it's the same thing for our clients. Often whatever is their greatest challenge is often as well their greatest strength. So I think what's important for us to remember that the things that we're challenged by could end up being our greatest strength.
The Reframe is a production of the International Association of Marriage and Family Counselors. If you enjoyed today's episode, please rate and review the show in Apple Podcasts. Thanks for listening. Join me next month on The Reframe.